No hot takes, no arguments, no nonsense. This is the home of Maine's best guest list, live from Bangor on WZON The Pulse, WKIT HD3, and the WZON app, Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Welcome into hour number two of Downtown. Special salute to the 1967 Red Sox as we remember the impossible dream season. Downtown brought to you as always by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. The second hour of the show comes your way thanks to the good people at United Insurance, 890 Hammond Street in Bangor, and Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Let's get this second hour of the program rolling as we welcome in one of the many writers who grew up watching the Boston Red Sox, who have fond memories of that 1967 season. Here's Steve Buckley of the Boston Herald.
My favorite memory didn't really happen the next day. I've written about this so many times, but when Billy Rohr threw the no-hitter, third game of the season down at Yankee Stadium, making his major league debut, as I've written many times, I like to think that the very next day after that, we all woke up and said, oh, my God, this team could win the pennant. No, but by the time summer had arrived, we were all saying, remember back in April, Billy Rohr? So that's why the Billy Rohr game, even though when it happened, wasn't on my radar as much as it would become later on. But I do remember July and August, and then it said, remember Billy Rohr? And, oh, yeah, that was where it all started. We didn't say it then. We applied it retroactively, and that's why that game. And Billy's become a dear friend of mine over the years. I've interviewed him a million times. He still texts me once in a while. So to me, that's my biggest memory, even though I arrived at it a couple of months late.
And you had a wonderful piece on Billy Rohr not too long ago, who won, what was it, two more games in his major league career?
Yes. And he got hurt, and they sent him out to the minors late in the season. Then he drifted on to the Indians, the Tigers, and the Expos, and he got released in the minor leagues or spring training by the Expos. And to his credit, he picked himself up. He went back to college, then he went to law school, and he's an attorney in Palm Springs, California right now, 71 years old.
And I love what he told you at the end of your piece about how he tells the story now that Elston Howard has passed on.
Yeah, well it's funny because he actually called me back about something else. And regarding this story and so forth. And just as he hung up, whoa, just one more thing. Hey, that thing with Elston Howard, I'm going to go back to that and rewrite history a little bit. It's two out in the ninth, and I forget exactly how he said it. I don't have it in front of me. Dropped a curve over, and I get the no-hitter. And he said, Elston's gone, who cares, kind of thing. And we all reach an age when we can rewrite our history if we choose.
I love that 67 team. They were my first Red Sox team that I adopted. Did you have a favorite player from that team beyond Yaz, who everybody adored?
My favorite player was Tony C. For the simple reason that I was born and raised in Cambridge, about 3 or 4 miles from Fenway Park. And my biggest memory of that era, even before 67, was I'm looking at the stats and stuff, and like Tony C was a local kid who was 11 years older than me when I was like 9. And I'm like, wait a minute. This kid is from the streets of Boston playing right field for the Red Sox. And if he can do it, why can't I do it? Well, you know, God has other intentions for me. But a lot of kids in Boston and throughout New England back in the 60s, Tony C was living proof that you don't have to be from Florida and have played at Alabama or whatever to make it with the Red Sox. And I was cognizant of that even as a child. And Tony C has always been a special player to me for that reason.
Well, and that team changed so much. It's hard to overstate what they did for Red Sox baseball in all of New England.
Well, there's two numbers I like to throw out. Number one, they hadn't won a pennant in 21 years until 67. But my favorite number is the 1953 season. The Boston Braves left town in the spring of 1953, leaving Boston as a one-team town. In 1953, attendance went down at Fenway Park. First year with only one baseball team, you'd think more people would go to Fenway, but the attendance went down. They were a mediocre team in the 50s. They were a horrible team in the 60s. And from 1953 through 1966, they did not grasp what they could have become earlier. And Yawkey lost interest in the team. They became complacent. It took the 67 Red Sox to turn Boston back into the baseball town it had not been for the 20 years prior to that.
Then they traveled to Yankee Stadium for an early April game. and a kid pitcher from Toronto knocked on the door of fame.
Billy Roar on the threshold with a tremendous performance today. 8 hits in the game, all of them belong to Boston. Roar winds, here it comes. Fly ball to deep left. Yastrzemski is going hard. Way back, way back. And he dives and makes a tremendous catch. One of the greatest catches we've ever seen by Yastrzemski in left field. Everybody in Yankee Stadium on their feet roaring as Yastrzemski went back and came down with that ball. Two down on the Yankee night. 3 runs, 8 hits for Boston. No runs, no hits for New York. Gibson with a sign. Roar into his windup. The left-hander delivers. Line drive into right field for a base hit. Tony Conigliaro taking it on the first hop. No chance. A line shot to right field has stopped the bid of Billy Roar for a no-hit game in his first major league start.
Well, what a night that was. In April of 1967, Yankee Stadium, the young pitcher on the threshold, as Ken Coleman said. Billy Roar, in his first major league start, 8 2/3 innings of no-hit baseball. Well, let's hear from the man himself, Bill Roar. When you heard the news that Dick Williams had been named the Red Sox manager, did you feel hopeful that you'd get a shot to make the big club?
I rather suspected I was going to get a shot. My recollection is that it was going to be a spring training battle, if you will, between me and Gary Wasluski and perhaps somebody else. And then I think over the winter they made a trade or two. And a couple of new guys came in, but yeah, I thought I was going to get a shot, and as it turns out, I had a pretty good spring and went north, as they say.
Well, and then opening game for the Yankees at Yankee Stadium. Here you are, ready to take the mound against the future Hall of Famer Whitey Ford. Exciting, intimidating, or all of those things?
Oh, I think it was probably all of the above. I do seem to recall throwing a warm-up pitch out in the bullpen into the Marine Corps marching band, into the bass drum. I wouldn't suggest that I was a little hyped up, but others might differ.
And you had a rookie catcher, too, Russ Gibson, who had spent almost a decade in the minor leagues getting his first start as well.
I did, and rest his soul, Gibby was just a rock, and he looked like a rock. He was built like a rock, but he was my catcher in Toronto, and he was my catcher in New York.
Well, another rookie got you a little leg up early in the game when Reggie Smith hit a home run. And when I think about that team, it was such a core of talented young guys. I believe that Yaz, among the starters, was the oldest guy at 27, 28 years old.
I expect he probably was, unless you want to throw in some of the real gray beards like George Thomas and some of those guys, but I'm not sure you count them in the number when you're talking about the regulars, because I think George played a lot, but I'm not sure he was considered the starter.
You had to have so many things going through your mind in making that first start in the big leagues, your debut at Yankee Stadium. At what point in the game did you start thinking no-hitter or realize that you had a no-hitter going?
I think it was probably when all my buddies quit talking to me. It gets very lonesome in the dugout when you are doing something like that, and the boys played it just according to the script, and I don't think anybody said a word to me after about the 6th inning until Dick came out in the 9th and asked me if I was okay. What the hell that meant, I'm not sure.
Well, you almost lost it in the 6th inning. Bill Robinson hit a shot that went off your leg, and Joe Foy had to make a heck of a play over at third.
He did, and I can tell you that Robinson, that was a very delicate shot, because at that time my leg was about 4 inches in circumference. But he got it right on the screws, as they say, and I thought at first it was probably broken, but yeah, Joe made a great play on the ball, and that certainly was ticketed for center field when he left the bat.
And then they brought in Mickey Mantle to pinch hit in the game. That had to be a thrill to face the Mick.
It was interesting, Rich, because whoever it was that was up before that, I think hit a fly ball to the outfield, and I was still looking out in that direction as they were throwing the ball around when that fellow came on and announced now batting for New York, number 7, Mantle. And I wasn't sure whether I should turn around and face him or just keep walking towards center field to lead. But thankfully, I think Mickey hit the first pitch. I think he hit it 400 feet, but luckily it was 200 straight up and 200 back down.
So you get to the ninth inning. Joe Foy had hit a home run to give you a little bit of breathing room there. And you get to the ninth inning, and Tommy Tresh hit a bomb, and one of the great catches out of many in the career of Carl Yastrzemski. What were you thinking at that moment as he made contact with that pitch?
Well, my first thought was it was going to wind up in the popcorn machine over the left field fence. But the next thing I thought of was when I saw number 8 headed for the wall and then dove and snow-coned the thing, my next thought was, yes, that's probably going to make you famous. And I've been telling him for the last half a century that it did, and I'm not sure he believes it.
I think the next batter flied out to Tony Canigliaro in right field, and then it was Elston Howard that broke up the magic and the no-hitter with that little hit into right field that Tony C. couldn't quite get to.
He did, and that was all Gibby's fault for calling the wrong pitch. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Now, you were saying in your email correspondence, though, that you've had time to think about it in the last 50 years, and maybe we're wrong about the way that game ended.
You could be, and actually I've sort of re-scripted the whole thing. It didn't take long. It's just one swing and miss, and boom, the game's over, and I got a no-hitter.
I do like that ending a whole lot better. Now, Ellie Howard would do it to you again about a week later, right, and keep you from getting a shutout.
He did. He took something off the Green Monster for I don't know if it was a long single or a double or something, but it knocked in a run, and I was certainly mindful to thank Ellie when he finally came over to Boston for all the headlines of mine that he had taken away.
So are you amused that 50 years later we're still talking about that game and, of course, that season, which was so memorable for New England fans?
Well, in one sense I am, except that over the years we've gone back to Fenway a few times. We went back for Tony C. night. We went back for the anniversary of Fenway, or birthday of Fenway Park. And as I have come to better appreciate the sports scene in New England, I get less and less surprised, because those folks don't forget, and they're terrific, and they love a winner, and we finally gave them one.
Well, not only that, and I've wondered this a lot, and I know that you got such a great reaction when you were back for that Fenway 100 celebration. Given the Red Sox history up until 2004 of coming close so many times but never getting that World Series title, do you think in some way, Bill, it's possible that the fans loved what you did even more because you came so close to that no-hitter without quite getting there?
Rich, I've heard the theory that I'm the poster boy for almost but not quite, and I get it, and I appreciate it. I still would have preferred to have gotten him out, but yeah, I think there's some association there just based upon, you know, after this many years, the people that recall it at all recall it the way they want to, and that's as it should be. And if they think that might have been a spark that ignited the season, good. I'm all in.
You've been an attorney for many years back where you grew up. Obviously now in the 50th anniversary, you're getting a lot more of these requests and even more people talking about it. But over those 50 years, on average, how many days would go by without someone bringing up what you did back in your 20s?
Oh, it happens from time to time, especially if somebody, you know, I still wear the pennant ring, and people notice that. Certainly the second week in April, I get phone calls and emails and things from various corners of the world, primarily in northeastern United States, but folks do recall.
Well, certainly we remember it very fondly here, and I have memories of it watching it, well, actually listening to it at the time, because we didn't get a lot of games on TV in those days, but also immortalized.
I thought you were going to say they hadn't invented it yet.
No, although I teach school now, and I've got students who are convinced that nothing was invented before 1998, so it's...
Oh, that's right.
It's entirely possible, but... My memories were solidified even more by the great record that was put together with Kenny Coleman's work. I'm sure, have heard a chance to listen to that through the years.
Oh, I absolutely have. Bless his heart. He was as good as anybody's ever been. I'm not sure Kenny ever got the recognition that was due him, but we know, the people in New England know, the people that knew him know, he was as good as anybody.
Billy Rohr remembers the Impossible Dream season of 1967 on the Best of Downtown. When we come back, Chad Finn of the Boston Globe, News Center's Pat Callahan, and we remember Tony Conigliaro.
Ben at the plate, waiting. Here's Rojas, winding, throwing. And there's a line drive to right center field, a base hit, going up the alley, rolling to the bullpen wall. All the way down, three runs will score. Seaburn has gone to third. Here's a throw to the plate to get Andrews, too late. It's three runs and a triple for Seaburn.
Trailing 8-0, Reggie Smith homered in the fourth to make it 8-1. Yaz had a three-run homer in the fifth. And they got four runs on three hits in the sixth and tied it.
Fly ball hit deep into left center field. And it is a home run. Adair has hit his second home run of the 1967 season, and the Red Sox, who trailed 8-0, are now leading in the eighth inning, 9-8.
Worried about buying a pre-owned vehicle? Experience the pre-owned difference with Quirk Auto Group. Every pre-owned vehicle from Quirk comes with a Carfax Vehicle History Report, a Quirk-certified pre-owned inspection, a 3-month, 3,000-mile limited warranty, and state inspections for the life of the vehicle. That's the Quirk pre-owned difference. Experience it for yourself at more than 10 statewide locations. It's your car. Find it at Quirk, quirkauto.com. Wholesale vehicles excluded from the 3-month, 3,000-mile limited warranty and main state inspections.
Road bike, mountain bike, hybrid, recumbent, tandem, no one size fits all when it comes to quality bicycles for the road or the trails. If you're interested in any type of bike, see the experts at Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates. Shop in person and online at slippinggears.com.
Do we ever agree on anything?
We both like the Bangor Mall Cinema 10.
The cozy stadium seating.
I like the bargain prices for all shows on Tuesday.
Hot buttered popcorn and candy.
The Dolby and digital surround sound is perfect.
I think I'll have a birthday party there for the kids.
I've got two tickets.
I hope one of them's for me.
So we can check out that action movie.
No, romance. Comedy.
Bangor Mall Cinema 10 at 557 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Call 942-1303 or visit online at yourneighborhoodtheater.com.
From Fort Kent to Portland, if you need insurance, turn to United. United Insurance is one of the largest independent insurance agencies in Maine, featuring a wide variety of personal and commercial insurance products. Backed by a select group of carriers, United delivers guidance and friendly personal attention. For commercial needs, talk with Pat Gattani or Todd Sosier. For personal auto and home insurance, talk to Navilla Rollins. Call United Insurance 207-385-2077 or online at unitedinsurance.net.
Hi, this is Eric.
And Christine.
From the Bangor Wine and Cheese Company, inviting you to come in and shop our carefully cultivated selection of fine wine, craft beer, meads, and ciders, and experience what has made Bangor Wine a fixture of Bangor's downtown for over 15 years.
Taste our delicious new Tavolo specialty oils and vinegars, artisan cheeses, cured meats, and crusty baguettes.
Bangor Wine & Cheese offers the service and knowledge to help anyone from the seasoned buyer to the nervous newcomer.
Bangor Wine & Cheese, family-owned and operated since 2000, is located at 86 Hammond Street in the heart of downtown Bangor.
Drink, eat, live better.
Petey the turn, that's a double play. Around the horn they go, and the inning comes to an end.
Hear every inning of every Red Sox game all season long on AM 620, The Pulse. Brought to you locally by Wendy's. Go for the classic junior bacon cheeseburger or the crispy chicken BLT in your 4 for $4. Served with 4 nuggets, small fries, and a drink at participating Wendy's for a limited time. And Quality Jewelers. For a simple birthday bracelet to a diamond engagement ring for the one, visit Quality Jewelers, Penobscot Plaza, Bangor, and Mill Mall, Ellsworth today.
Ellsbury looks up and it's gone. A home run. Hanley Ramirez's second home run in as many days.
Join the voice of the Red Sox, Joe Castiglione and Tim Neverett, all season long as the Red Sox push for the postseason.
Curve in there, strike three, and the ball game is over. A beautiful bender.
Catch every Red Sox game on AM 620, The Pulse.
Can you believe it?
Then, one August night, the kid in right lies sprawling in the dirt. The fastball struck him square. He's down. Is Tony badly hurt? The doctors say he'll be okay, but he won't be back this year. If Tony's through, what can they do? Who'll carry them from here?
Yes, indeed. August of 1967, a guy with so much potential, Tony Canigliaro, the youngest home run champion in American League history, the second youngest to ever reach 100 home runs in the midst of a terrific season for the Red Sox, felled by a pitch from Jack Hamilton of the California Angels. And as others have told us, the story of Tony Canigliaro is nearly Shakespearean in its level of tragedy. Author David Cattaneo has written a book on the subject, Tony C, The Triumph and Tragedy of Tony Canigliaro, and he remembered the Red Sox terrific right fielder.
I was on the Red Sox beat for the Boston Herald from 1987 to 1991. And not having grown up in New England, I grew up in New York, I didn't really appreciate the Tony C. legend or his importance to fans until I went on the Red Sox beat. And when I was on the Red Sox beat, people of a certain age spoke of him in these sort of wistful terms. They had such a reverence for this guy. And when they asked me to do the book, I knew it was a good story, and I jumped at the chance.
Well, and of course, it plays out like an American tragedy, and everything coming up roses when he broke into the league in 1964, a home run champion at 20 years old, and the talent that Tony C. possessed was absolutely real.
It was, and therein, I think, is where the people find that wistfulness, and it's the classic what might have been story. Somebody who showed a lot of promise at a very young age, and then when it's cut down at a very young age, their imaginations have a lot of, there's a lot of fuel for your imagination that anything could have been possible. I mean, he was 22 when he got hit, which effectively ended the greatness that he had. I mean, he had some great years afterwards, just on sheer will. But he was 22, and you realize that Carl Yastrzemski did not come into his own until 1967, when Yaz was in his 28th year. So ball players at 22 are just a work in progress, and Tony C. could have been anything, basically.
Well, I remember that night as a kid very well, in August of 67, hit by that pitch. He missed the rest of that year, all of the 1968 season, and then came back, was comeback player of the year in 1969, and oddly enough, had his most productive season in 1970, 36 homers, 116 RBIs, and then after the fact said, I did that with one eye closed because he had double vision.
Yeah, he did, and part of the story that after he sat out the 68 baseball season, but in the fall of 68, he got it in his head that he would come back as a pitcher.
Right,
that's
right.
How much he wanted to come back and play big league baseball. That didn't work out. But he worked at it, and he went to the Winter League, and he pitched. What he did in 69 and 70, he really did do it with maybe one and a half eyes. When he was injured, it changed his vision just enough so that his depth perception was thrown off. And over time, the brain, I know this from talking to the doctors and stuff when I did the book, the brain can adjust to a certain amount so that you can regain some sort of depth perception. But he never had what he had before he got hit. And he did it on sheer will for the most part.
And we mentioned that he enjoyed every bit of that celebrity. He had a recording contract for a while, was dating Hollywood starlets, and I guess was living the dream of any 20-something kid in Boston back in the 60s.
He was. I mean, I recount the story in the book where he's driving through Kenmore Square. He's like 24 years old. He's in a red Corvette. It's a summer night. He just hit a home run for the Red Sox, and he's going on to the town. He's like, you talk, like you said, living the dream. And part of his story is that he was different from, he broke in 64 when he was 19. He was one of the first. Technically, he wasn't a baby boomer because he was born in July of 45, but he really was the first baby boomer sort of baseball star. And there was a real generation gap that the young people really embraced him with. He was not that modest. He didn't want to wait his turn. He said he sang rock and roll records, and he went out with starlets who were 20 years older than he was. And the older, a lot of older people, the older press members, some of the coaches, you know, World War II Depression era guys, didn't like this kid so much who was kind of brash and played his music too loud. But younger people just went crazy for him. He was the perfect celebrity for those times.
Yeah, and wasn't there a little friction too between Tony C, who had all of this natural ability, and Carl Yastrzemski, who had to work really hard to get where he got in Major League Baseball?
There was a natural rivalry early on. In 67, as you certainly remember, you know, that was the year of Yaz. Yaz raced way ahead of him in terms of superstardom after that. There was some friction afterwards, and the Red Sox clubhouse, in certainly in 1970, it had its factions. There was a Yaz faction, and there was a Tony C faction, for whatever reason. Reggie Smith was involved. It was really a kind of a toxic clubhouse. But when Yaz was interviewed for this book, he had nothing but respect, in retrospect, for and admiration for Tony C and his talent. So a lot of that stuff dissipates, of course, over time. But in the heat of the clubhouses in those days, there was some friction, yes.
Well, and you also had the family factor, too, with his brother Billy Coniglio being a part of the team.
That was partly is what fueled the feud. In the clubhouse, in that you had Billy C, you had Tony C, and you had Yaz and Reggie Smith, and people were just picking sides. We've all worked in offices or lived in places where that happens, and it happened in that clubhouse, unfortunately for Tony and for Yaz to some extent.
We're talking with author David Cattaneo. The book is entitled Tony C, The Triumph and Tragedy of Tony Coniglio, and the tragedy began with that beaning in 67, and then, boy, it continued. He tried to come back in 75. That was pretty short-lived. Here's a guy who was part of two American League championship teams and never got to taste the postseason himself, and then had some business failures, and then was in the process of trying to become a Red Sox broadcaster when he suffered the heart attack and the stroke that ultimately would lead to his death.
Correct. He had interviewed for the Red Sox color commentator job that Hawk Harrelson was leaving at the time. And by all accounts, as far as I could piece together, the job probably would have been his. And looking at it, he was a natural. He literally was a local boy. He had that little greater Boston accent that would endear himself to people around here. He was blunt. And it's not difficult to imagine that he would have been a presence, a Jerry Remy-like presence for another couple of generations of Red Sox fans. Because by all accounts, he would have been great at that job. And then he's being driven to the airport after auditioning for it by his brother, and he had a heart attack, and his brain was deprived of oxygen for too long. And basically, he suffered brain damage, for lack of a better term, which debilitated him for the rest of his life.
What was the most surprising thing you learned about Tony C in your research?
The most surprising thing was that it was the part that, I mean, I knew, again, just from soaking it up. I knew that he was brash. I knew that he was a sort of a playboy. I knew that he didn't wait for his stardom. So he had this reputation as being this cocky kid. The part that I never, we didn't know back in Boston, was really what was going on with him when he went out to California. He got a job in the San Francisco area doing sports, you know, the local sports, you know, at 6 and 11. And there was kind of a gap in his story. And in my research, talking to people who knew him out there, and some people knew him really well, he grew up out there. And those people talked about him looking back on his career, and like most of us did when we get into our 30s. We look back when we were in our 20s, and he was sort of, you know, I overdid it. I should have done that. And he was there was a sweet, serious, really compassionate side to him that I learned about when I interviewed the people who knew him in San Francisco.
Well, and what's interesting, too, is that he's sort of in that pantheon of those who died young athletically in Boston, Harry Agganis and Tony Canigliera. But you think back to the James Deans of the world that are in the image of a lot of fans, still that 22-year-old that could just crush the ball and have that perfect Fenway Park swing. But for the family, I'm sure it's a very different memory of Tony C.
The family, obviously it was a huge blow to the family. He had a very tightly knit family, very supportive family. And his father was a guy who cared about his son very much. Obviously, he loved him very much, and he pushed him. And part of his pushing him was to help him achieve greatness. And his father had died by the time I did the book, but talking to his family members, there's a slowly feel a sense of shock and disbelief. They couldn't believe it, that all this promise in the middle of this dream season, 1967, the impossible dream, Boston baseball has been revived. They're the talk of the town, and he gets hit, and this happens to him. They still couldn't believe it all the years later that with one pitch, so much had changed.
I know that there are those in Boston who also believe that his number should be retired at Fenway Park. Did people talk with you about that along the way?
They had, and that was part of when I was covering the Red Sox. That was a main source of my knowledge. That boy, they really loved this guy. I mean, he didn't play that long, and you know his statistics were not outstanding over the course of his career, but he was so beloved that people were very adamant about wanting to retire his number. And after researching the book and hearing his story firsthand, I can understand why.
Well, I'm trying to think if it was during your tenure covering the Sox, but one of the ultimate indignities at the end there, the night that they were honoring him, Tony C. Night at Fenway Park, was also the night when Buddy LaRue staged his ownership coup.
Yeah, that was before I worked for the Herald at the time, but I wasn't on the beat. But I remember that fiasco. There's no other word for it.
Mm.
I just remember that fiasco very, very vividly. And it was just, talk about poor timing.
It's David Cattaneo here on the Best of Downtown. Let's check in with more folks who have some memories, or in the case of our next guest, Chad Finn of the Boston Globe, who wasn't even alive back in 1967, certainly has learned about it over time from friends and relatives and from the people involved.
Yeah, it's funny. In that documentary, Peter Gammons talks about it, how people used to come up to him and say, you know, the Braves should have stayed here, the Red Sox should have moved. And they had no crowds or buzz or anything before 67. That team caught everybody completely by surprise. It became a phenomenon, and it really was the birth of Red Sox Nation. I know the culture changed in 2004 when they actually won a World Series, and it went to a whole different level. But the feeling of the Red Sox being an essential heart and soul part of the Boston experience, that began in 67. And, you know, we're all cynics these days. People live through that and still revel in that and get all nostalgic about it. We can kind of roll our eyes sometimes and say, yeah, sure, you didn't even win the World Series. But this documentary does a fantastic job, and it's on again at 10 o'clock at night, tonight if you've missed it, Sunday on the MLB Network. This documentary does a fantastic job of laying out exactly why this is so important in Red Sox history. It's incredible footage you've never seen before. Yeah, Tony C, Jim Lonborg, and they're really fortunate that most of the people that were part of that team are still alive and still really sharp and able to talk about it. Mike Andrews, Rico Petroselli, guys like that. So highly recommended. I didn't live there. I was alive for about 40 days in the 60s. But it's something that I think every Red Sox fan should understand and appreciate.
Seems like everybody's got memories of that 1967 season. Pat Callahan of News Center at WCSH with some very special ones.
It was a great time to be, this again, I was 10 and turned 11 years old that summer. It was a great time to be a baseball fan in New England, growing up outside of Boston. That's because they'd been a pretty bad team before that, but the Cardiac Kids really, really woke up the whole region, and it was so much fun to listen to. And you realize they were a team where everybody at some point could contribute. Sure, that season doesn't happen without Yastrzemski, who may have had the best single season any player's ever had. Some people have speculated, even as great as his numbers were, they don't reflect how important he was to that team because he was such a leader. But there were George Scott and Jim Lonborg, Rico Petroselli, all of these guys, and everybody would step up. And so I was fortunate in that my dad was a sportscaster in Boston, so I had met some of the players over the years. And when the Red Sox went to the World Series, he got tickets to the first game. So I got to see the first game of the World Series at Fenway Park, and it was exciting because we got to see Bob Gibson pitch for the St. Louis Cardinals. And in those days, there was no interleague play, so you never saw a National League great like that in the American League parks. But we did, and of course, unfortunately, Gibson beat the Red Sox that day, as he did three times in that series. There was no shame in losing 1-0 to Bob Gibson. Lonborg couldn't pitch because, as you recall, back then, there were no playoffs, and so the Red Sox got into the World Series on the last day of the season. The World Series started 2 or 3 days later, and Lonborg wasn't ready to pitch. But it was what a great experience to be part of, and I'll never forget it. And it was funny because they played games on weekdays back then, which seems impossible now. World Series games are always at night. But they played, it was like a Tuesday or Wednesday afternoon, I don't remember. And I was going to St. Bridget's School in Framingham, and I had to tell the sisters that I wasn't going to be in class that day. And they kind of look at you as, well, you better have a good reason. And when I told them it was because I was going to see the Red Sox in the World Series, they gave their blessing and said, just bring us back a program. And indeed I did. And we got to watch every game of the series that was on a school day, the whole of that seven-game, that two-week period, because there were never more loyal Red Sox fans than the Sisters of St. Joseph.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I remember, I think I was in fifth grade, and I remember the teacher rolling a TV, which was a big deal in those days, rolling a TV into the classroom so we could watch game one.
That's what we did, yeah. It was great. That was, there's some things that are important in life, and they recognized that to young fans in particular, this was something important.
That's Pat Callahan of News Center and WCSH-TV. Our salute to the 67 Red Sox continues next with Mike Lowe and the Red Sox starting shortstop from 50 years ago.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
From Fort Kent to Portland, if you need insurance, turn to United. United Insurance is one of the largest independent insurance agencies in Maine, featuring a wide variety of personal and commercial insurance products. Backed by a select group of carriers, United delivers guidance and friendly personal attention. For commercial needs, talk with Pat Gattani or Todd Sosier. For personal auto and home insurance, talk to Navilla Rollins. Call United Insurance 207-385-2077 or online at unitedinsurance.net.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Green Acres Kennel in Bangor is your source for wholesome food and quality supplies for healthy and happy pets. They pride themselves on their emphasis on quality foods made by small, family-owned companies that are committed to wholesome pet nutrition. The staff at Green Acres Kennel undergoes continuing education on pet nutrition and will never recommend a food that they wouldn't feel comfortable feeding their own pets, no matter how popular it is, and that's what sets them apart from big chains. But don't just go to Green Acres for food. They also carry treats, grooming supplies, training aids, toys, supplements, and accessories like collars, harnesses, and leashes for all your canine and feline friends. And they have excellent prices. Sign up for Green Acres Customer Rewards Program and their Frequent Buyer Program to get the most bang for your buck. Visit them today at greenacreskennel.com or stop by at 1653 Union Street in Bangor.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home.
When you come to call the honor roll, you ponder where to start. Each man made his contribution. Each man played his part. The man who served as leader in the field and at the plate, with his glove and hustle, with his bat and muscle, was the fabulous number 8.
Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, the man they call Yast, we love him. Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, what power he has. Our Boston team is always on the beam, cause we got Yast. We fans, we stomp and clap our hands, and Yaz is Jazz. Those rival pitchers on the mound all shake. They dread each windup that they have to take. When number 8 is standing at the plate, and then he swings. Wow, there it goes again. Wow, there it goes again. Hits one off the wall, and there's Yastrzemski going for the ball. They try for two, the runner knows he's through. Ah, look at Yaz! Wow, he threw him out again. Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, the man they call Yaz. Carl Yastrzemski, Carl Yastrzemski, he's the idol of Boston, Mass. On Beacon Hill, he gives them quite a thrill. In Southie, too, there's lots of whoop-de-doo. In the North End, they call Carl friend, and they hope the season will never end. From Wellesley Way, they come to watch him play. And on Cape Cod, they take a holiday from all about. They come to shout, yell for Yaz to hit one out. The state of Maine is going quite insane. And in Vermont, it's only Yaz they want. From every state, they come and wait to see Yastrzemski at home plate. Our Boston team, it's always on the beam, cause we got Yaz. We Fenway fans, we stomp and clap our hands, and Yaz is Jazz. Although Yastrzemski is a lengthy name, it fits quite nicely in our Hall of Fame. We love him so. In Boston, we all know that when he swings, yeah, here we go again.
Jess Kane of WHDH in Boston with a song that, well, any kid over the age of such and such remembers very well from the 67 season. One of those guys, Sports Writer of the Year, Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald, who has great memories of watching that 67 team.
I was 10 years old, and it was really my first experience with rooting for a team. God, I, you know, if we weren't watching them on WSBK Channel 38 with the rabbit ears and the snowy reception, we were listening to them on the radio, and my brother Harry, who is 3 years older than me, is keeping score in a scorebook as we're listening to the radio, which nobody does anymore, but he still has the scorebook. But I can remember just the excitement of that team. Billy Rohr, almost no hitter in Yankee Stadium with Yastrzemski making that incredible catch in left field. We had the record, the Impossible Dream, as soon as it came out. We played it until it was all scratched and worn out. I can still see Rico Petrocelli catching that little looper to clinch the pennant, or at least hopefully, because they had to wait to see how another game turned out. But you know, who cared? The fans stormed the field. Jim Longbook's shirt was torn off. It was my first experience with anything like that. And I wrote something when the Red Sox won in 2004, because my son was 10 years old at that point. And it was the same thing with him. That was his first experience with a team like that. And there were a lot of things that made me think about 67 during that whole, 2004 year. But I remember going to one game. It was the Greater New Bedford Little League every year. We had a game. We went to see, and Russ Gibson was a hero of ours because he was from nearby Fall River.
That's right.
So, he was catching that day, and we were all excited about it. And, I think he, went 0-for-4 and struck out 3 times, but we didn't care. The Red Sox won that day. We were all happy. And, it was something that as a fan, I'll never forget that year. It was simply amazing.
All right, I'm going to test you then, see if you can finish this, and I'm sure you can. And then one night, the kid in right lies sprawling in the dirt. The fastball struck him square. He's down.
He's hurt.
The doctors say he'll be okay, but he won't be back this year. With Tony gone, what can they do? Who'll carry them from here?
You have a better memory than me.
And then it went right into Kyle Yastrzemski. Kyle Yastrzemski.
The man they call Yaz. We love him.
There you go. Jess Kane of WHDH on that. Was Yaz your favorite on that team?
Mike Andrews was my favorite on that team.
Oh, I loved Mike Andrews. He was great.
I played second base. So, of course, I was 10 years old, Little League, first time playing Little League, played second base. And I wanted to be Mike Andrews.
Many, many years ago, one of those traveling barnstorming team of former players came up, and there were some pretty good names there. Oil Can Boyd, of course, Bill Lee is always on those things. But for me, as a kid who grew up loving that 67 team, I was so excited not just to meet but to hang out after the game with Dalton Jones.
Dalton Jones was spectacular. I mean, he came through with so many big hits that year. He was money. Whenever you needed something, he gave it, he delivered.
Absolutely. Hey, Mike, it's great.
Elston Howard breaking up the no-hitter and then coming back to the Red Sox.
Jerry Adair, Norm Seaburn, so many of those role players that did it all.
Come on.
Yeah, Tarbell throwing out Ken Burry.
Ken Burry. How did that happen?
How do we remember that from 50 years ago?
That's because our minds are full of useless information.
Exactly. Can't remember my way home at night, but I know who played second base in the 67 Red Sox. There you go.
That's right.
That's Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald here. The best of downtown. We remember the 1967 Red Sox on this 50th anniversary of their tremendous American League championship run. The starting shortstop for that team, this guy, Rico Petrocelli.
Every time we have a reunion, we realize how lucky we were and how fortunate to be on that team to turn things around. And it wasn't important because, they always compare teams and World Series. It wasn't as important as us not winning it, but just the fact that it brought back interest in baseball here in New England, because the teams prior to that were terrible. I know. I was on two of them. We lost 199 games in 2 years. So nobody liked that, and no one wanted to come and even talk about the Red Sox. But in 67, turned it around. It was an exciting team, young, new manager and everything, and people were so excited. And from that year on, people couldn't wait till spring training came and the Red Sox might win a world championship. They got in there, and now, even though they didn't win, but maybe next time they're going to win it. So it was exciting, especially 2004 when they finally did win it. It was great.
You talked about the manager. Dick Williams passed away earlier this year. Talk about him and his influence on you as a young player.
Well, Dick was tough. In those days, you know, you can get away with it. When I say tough, you know, he wasn't afraid to discipline us and to let us know when we made mistakes, you know, especially mental mistakes. He went wild over making a mental mistake, and he knew, you know, errors were part of the game. But if you forgot to cover a bag or something like that, you know, your head was somewhere else, boy, he let you know it. But we learned a lot from him. You know, we learned a lot about the fundamentals of the game, how important it is to do the little things. And one of the things he brought to that team was was a different style of baseball. It was, you know, not just hitting home runs and playing for the big innings. It was going to be defense and getting the runner over, hitting the cutoff man, getting the bunt down, and man alive, you made sure you did it because you know you were going to hear from him.
That 1967 season, of course, you had a terrific year. Carl Yastrzemski was Mr. Everything. I know Yaz is a guy who likes to stay out of the spotlight. Do you get to see him at all anymore?
Not too much. No, Carl is he lives in the Massachusetts area up in the North Shore for half the year, and then he goes to Florida for the other half. And he's been through some tough times. You know, he lost his son.
Right.
Early 40s, and yeah, his dad also, you know, so it's been a little tough for him, but he's never been a guy that really likes the limelight, you know, likes to be out in crowds and stuff. He'll make appearances here and there, but really not too often. And we joke around about it, you know, he's there for a few minutes and then you turn around, where's he at? He's gone.
Well, that's because he's a Long Island guy and not a Brooklyn guy like you.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
Rico, you've done so much in your career. Of course, a long, outstanding career as a player, but you were a manager, you were a broadcaster for a lot of years. As you look back on a life lived in sports, what are the things that stand out for you?
Well, you know, I look back at it now, and I think the older you get, the more you appreciate it. What a blessing it's been for me and my family. Of course, I met my wife through baseball. I got to do a lot of traveling through baseball. Met a lot of great people. And also, the fans of New England have been just fabulous to me. I mean, they've been wonderful. And lifelong friends, you know, I've made over the years. And it's been great. It's been more than I ever expected.
Rico Petrocelli remembering his role in that exciting 1967 Impossible Dream season. We hope you've enjoyed this look back 50 years, a Red Sox team that endures after all this time, will be celebrated throughout the year, and for those who watched it happen, will be celebrated for years and years to come. For Downtown, I'm Rich Kimble.
The pitch is looped towards shortstop. Petrocelli's back. He's got it. The Red Sox win. And it's pandemonium on the field.
Ken Coleman speaking to you from the happiest place in America today, the Red Sox dressing room at Fenway Park, where everyone has just finished listening to the ball game and the ball players outside are really excited and very happy, as you can well imagine, as the Boston Red Sox have won the 1967 American League pennant.
For Boston is a tradition town with a history to uphold. And when Bostonians remember, this story will be told. Proudly, fathers will tell their sons of this year and this team how by courage and grit and refusing to quit, they forged our impossible dream.